So today, this morning's going to be a very unusual share. It is really actually the outcome of a correspondence that that I was able to share with one of the most outstanding young men in our community. And just because his family's here, and I know he wouldn't want to me to say this himself, but you know, we have Avi and Adina here, and we have grandparents and siblings, so it's an opportunity just to mention, you know, this is an outcome of the last 8 weeks of Yair being in a foreign country in Uganda for a residency, for a medical residency. But actually, Yair's a very unusual person. Besides for being just a fabulous individual, Yair won't tell you that he was also the valedictorian of Yeshiva College. Now, I've worked in Yeshiva University, and I can tell you that you have over there 1,200 men who every one of their mothers is basically doing college for them, telling them that they need to get the best grades. To get to the short list of being a valedictorian in Yeshiva College, we're talking, not never mind the 4.0s in the GPAs, just to be able to get onto that list. I mean, these are kids who are the best of the best in any formal fashion, never mind doing pre-med at the same time. Yair is also the engineer of something called Project Start, which is a program for which involves tutoring in public high schools, not just Jewish high schools, public high schools across New York. And it was so popular that, in fact, it
was adopted across three countries already.
And recently I presented it in Yale about the program, which is now even in Zimbabwe, go figure. Project Start with tutoring. And yeah, I was really making an incredible impact. And so it was really an honor for me to be able to have the opportunity to have this correspondence in his time in Uganda. So at this point, I'd like just to turn it over to Yair himself.
So that's why I escaped to Uganda. So Uganda is in East Africa, for those who don't know, including myself before I went there. It's the one in red. And while I was working there for 2 months, I was working in Kisoro District Hospital for 1 month. I was working in the village for 1 month. And a lot of halacha questions came up. But before we get there, I just want to address something that I was asked a lot when I came back. How do I look the same as when I went there, as opposed to looking much skinnier? So I brought a lot of food from home. That's one. So that helped. But I'll show you in a couple of slides what my food supply from home looked like at the end of the trip. Besides for that, I also found a couple things like Pringles, which certainly helped. And I brought my own pot. And so with my own pot, I was able to cook a lot of food. There were bananas, there were avocados, there were potatoes, sweet potatoes, carrots, beans, rice. A lot of food that I could make in a pot. Just to show you, this is my food supply when I left. Still some M&Ms, not much of anything else. And when I was there, in the middle of Uganda, or really the south of Uganda, on the border of Rwanda and Congo, in a place called Kisoro, I did have some rabbinic help. So it took me a little while to get the internet to work on my phone. It took me a little while to actually get the phone to work at all. But I remember there was this one time I was stuck in the middle of I guess, effectively nowhere. And it was going to be Shabbos, and I didn't know exactly where I could walk. Couldn't reach Rabbi Trump, couldn't really reach anybody. And then I figured out how to call with WhatsApp to home. And Yigal actually had one phone on WhatsApp on with me, one phone on with Rabbi Teitelbaum, and he was funneling the question back and forth as far as how I can actually eat, how I can walk around. So very helpful. And I also emailed Rabbi Trump very often back and forth. That's why I put on the rest of the pictures of Rabbi Trump. So the first... Why did I do this? So I did it for two main reasons. One was the best clinical doctor that I had worked with, Jerry Passion, was going there to Uganda. So I had worked with him in Montefiore Hospital. I asked him how I could work with him more. He told me he's going to Uganda. So I wanted to learn, so I followed him there. Second is, it's exciting. I went to Uganda. So the first set of topics we're going to address are within Kashrut, and most importantly is survival foods. This is when I went to a coffee plantation pretty early on with a bunch of these kids. I have a coffee bean in my mouth, which we're going to find out if it's kosher or not. And so that's where we'll start with survival foods. Chicken eggs. So I bought a chicken when I was there. Chicken costs like $5 to buy, about $5, a little bit more, $5.50. So the reason I bought the chicken was because I was staying over at this person's house. This is Daffy. She doesn't own the house. She's a child there. And I wanted to bring a housewarming gift over there. You don't really bring chocolate or chocolate-covered pretzels with sprinkles. You bring a chicken or, you know, something nice. So I bought a chicken in the meantime before I gave it. The chicken lays eggs. But most of the eggs that I ate were from, like, a store near to where I was staying. I was staying in a place called Afia Clinic Housing. And so I was there was a store nearby that sold eggs, local eggs.
What do you mean, eggs? Most of the eggs?
Meaning most of the, I guess all of the eggs that I ate were from there. Except there were also other stores that sold eggs. And so it wasn't just from this local store. Sometimes I bought in the supermarket also. I didn't use my chicken. But we'll find out why. So my question was, like, do I need to check all of the eggs for blood spots or not? What exactly are the eggs that I can eat? Can I cook all of my eggs? Like, here in America, I know I don't need to be so worried about it. The eggs are mostly kept apart. And so I'm not worried about it being fertilized. Even if there is a blood spot in there, I wouldn't be so worried. But over there, I actually found a blood spot, or what I thought was a blood spot. I've never actually been certain that I've seen one before, in the white of my egg. So I wasn't sure if I could eat it. I ended up throwing out the egg. So that was one of the questions that I asked Rabbi Trump.
Okay, so what we're going to do is I want to try to divide up every scenario, because Yair essentially is all of us, meaning we all experience these scenarios, as Yair is experiencing them in a more extreme fashion. And what really this allows us to do is to be able to explore halacha without perhaps the luxuries of society, which has afforded us the protection where we don't have to think about these things, many of the things that Yair has to think about. So Yair really is our sort of prototype of reappreciating the basic structure of Jewish life. And what I'd like to do is, as we're going to go through each thing, we're going to deal with issue, concept, and source. Okay, so the issue is chicken eggs and the blood spots. The concepts that are that we need to investigate is blood times and blood spots in the time of Shulchan Aruch and blood spots today. We're going to go through one or two sources. I'd like to also just publicly thank Rabbi Dov Schrei and Rabbi Eli Gersten from the OU, who are very helpful, because a lot of the questions, we're not going to cover all the questions that Yara dealt with, but some of the questions have to deal with machinery, you know, like production plants and how foods are produced, which are more complex things, which are, the OU was very helpful. It's also about Ariel Leibovitz for going through a number of the shalas as well. So let's start at the beginning. So the Shulchan Aruch tells us, based on a very complex Machlokes Rishonim, the Shulchan Aruch tells us in source 1, the first page, Dam beitzim im yadushu merukam me'ahayfrach. If we have a blood in an egg and we know that it's coming, it is because of the development of the fetus, or the chick. Chayavim alav, the chayavim alav means it's an isur to araisa. If we don't know that it's because an egg was actually fertilized, then in that particular case, we say that it's still an Issa Drabonim. Now, the Shulchan Aruch goes through an incredibly complex discussion, because there's a three-part Machlokes Rishonim, whether, if you find the blood spot in a fertilized egg, if it's part of the yolk, or is it part of the white, or both, or it comes from a place called a Kesher, which is where the egg was starting to develop, and it spreads outwards, where is it Osir? Very complex, and as a function of the complexity, the Rama tells us in Sif Gimel, Mizen Yish Pashir Amin Abi Benidu Seilu Leso Kol Beisa Shiesh Bo Dam Ve'en Machalkin Ve'en Chelmon Nechelbon. Our minag is that any blood spot we find in an egg, says the Rama, we say it's Osir completely. There's no questions asked, because it's so complex to know where the Kesher is, and if it's spreading out of the Kesher into the white, and if it's touching the white and the Chelmon. Very complicated. So therefore, the Rama says we have a minhag to machmir across the board, and he says that there are people who may kill and to take out the blood spot with a clipper, which is an area with surrounding it. However, that's not what we do today. That's not what we do today. The reason that's not what we do today is because there's a tshuvas Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe says we're not going to do the tshuva inside, but Rav Moshe says the following. Very simply. Today, in farms, most what he calls farms, he spells it Pei Aleph Resh Mem Ayin Resh Sanach, farms. Okay, so Rav Moshe says that in farms today, most eggs are unfertilized, meaning chickens will lay egg based on daylight cycles. So meaning to say, and in fact, what happens is that the farmers will create intensify daylight cycles so that we lay in more and more and more eggs, which is what they generally do. However, happens to be But he has testimony from a number of farmers who say that the farmers will still have chickens which do have fertilized eggs because it actually strengthens them, it's good for the produce. And so they'll have a mixture of fertilized and non-fertilized eggs, and then a lot of times they'll actually mix them up and sell them. So Rav Moshe feels that because the vast majority of eggs today are unfertilized, therefore we treat them with much less severity. And if we find a blood spot, we don't treat it like the severity of the Ramah. You can take out that blood spot, the rest of the egg is mutter. Even if you're only cooking one egg and you find a blood spot, you know, you're usually supposed to cook three. A dozen us or the rest, that's what Rav Moshe feels. However, his last point is the following. Rav Moshe, if you just flip to the top of the top of page, 2nd paragraph, he says, Aval Lamaisa, Kevin de Bebeitza, like Nefshav of Meruba de Rubba de Anoshim, have said to Klal. Since an egg really is not going to break the financial camel's back, says Rav Moshe, seeing as we've seen that the Shulchan Aruch is machmir for all the shittos, Ashur Rakni Drabona Shuhaya Lanu Leilech Lahakel, Mashalai Motsinu Zebeshar Dvarim, Afbi Isurim Doras. Since we're machmir on all the shittos, Lachain Kevon Shal Koponim Ikom Mute, Deboy Mizacharim Shadam Oyster Kolabetsa Minaroy Lahakmir Ashur and Mizamidina. So Rav Moshe says, understand that it's not Midin. But being as we try to be machmir, an egg isn't worth so much, then one should try to be machmir. If one finds a blood spot, doesn't affect the rest of the eggs, one should try to be machmir, says Rav Moshe. So this is the general practice today. We check our eggs, even if there's an assumed vast majority of unfertilized eggs, therefore the blood spot can be removed in and of itself. The complication is that it wasn't necessarily the case, right?
So for the chicken that I bought, I found out, I had no idea, that for certain types of chickens, they only lay eggs if they were with a rooster. And so then the egg would necessarily be much more likely to be fertilized. So for this chicken, which actually laid 5 eggs by the time that I left, I didn't eat any of the eggs because all of the eggs would have been fertilized, or almost all of the eggs would have been fertilized.
Right, and so in the particular case where they'd be fertilized, we revert back to the psak of the Ramah, which means that we need to check it. If you do check it and you find any blood spot, then it's bad, but if you check and there's nothing, you should be fine. So that's what ends up actually happening. And I say that's actually, generally today on the market, fertilized eggs are sold at a premium. That's supposed to be actually, in fact, more of greater organic value than regular eggs. So it's interesting that you have to sometimes go out to Uganda to find exactly, a case where we go back to original Pesach or Shulchan Aruch, which is not the case of what we have today on the whole.
Can you accept that Rav Moshe's Pesach is based upon the situation in America? Even the supermarket in
Good question. Yeah, I think that we'll be surprised how sophisticated like an African country is, actually. Meaning there are certain aspects which are very backwards and very, very primitive. When it comes to things like farming and food production, they have a lot of availability of the regular food, and I would assume that the farms in Uganda are running on the same principles. Maybe not as intense in terms of the life cycles that we're straining our chickens to produce on, but I would imagine that most of the chickens that are there are actually unfertilized, and they're just using them for this purpose. You should definitely check them, but in the end of the day, I would assume that Rav Moshe's rive holds true even for the farmed eggs which you find in the supermarket true too as well. Anyway, so it gets more exciting.
So I made many eggs, and in one of the I made it usually in this like hot water boiler that I would plug in because I didn't have a stove in my room. I had to walk across. It rained a lot. I didn't like to walk across to the stove, so I would often make it in this like little water boiler. And once I found a fly, there were lots of flies, even though it's high elevation, there's actually less mosquitoes there in Kisoro than there are here. There were a lot of flies, and so I found a fly in my boiled eggs. So I didn't know, can I eat those eggs or not? At first I was thinking I should probably be batel b'shishim, and then I was thinking, but it's a fly, so it's a beria. There's a concept that if there's a whole fly, a whole something that was alive, then that's not batel. But then I was thinking that it's not batel if I don't know what it is, but if I just take it out, then it probably should be batel again. So I ended up eating those eggs. And luckily, I think I did right in that case.
Exactly. So the concepts at hand that Yair was talking about, two concepts were the notion of bitzel and the notion of beria. The way bitzel works in general is is that the general principle, and this is what we're most familiar with, and this is a default principle, but there's a number of exceptions. Default principle is that there's a notion that which is called bittul. Now, bittul means that there's a nullification. The way the Shulchan Aruch describes it is the following. The Shulchan Aruch describes, this is the beginning of Tzariches Aleph. This is the beginning of the Shulchan Aruch talks about Hilchos Taharos, one of the most complex areas in Halacha, and it is the area that all Rabbanim need to go through. This is Kashrus 101. The first Halacha is extremely complicated. But the Shulchan Aruch says the following. Isur Shinus Arav Beheter, this is on page 2, Isur Shinus Arav Beheter, Min B'Sheina Minai. Let's say you have two mixture of two things, and they're separate substances. Kegoin, Chalosh Shinus Arav Bebasar, you have a drop of milk which falls into your chalons. Okay? Yitamenu Nachri, the way you decide if there's been nullification is, what do? You can't taste it, because what happens if you taste the milk? So what do? You give it over to somebody who has no Isur or Basar V'Chalosh. So they should taste it, a non-Jewish person. If they can't taste the milk, or if they say that they can't taste it, but it's bad tasting, then you say that it's mutter. Why? Because we've created bittul. There's been a nullification process. Of course, that the milk's not, the item added is not going to improve. But when you're asking this laundry, they need to be in a position where they're not realizing that you're relying on them for halachically. The idea of kfeila, this idea of using a non-Jewish person to taste, is generally very complex. There's a number of conditions which the Noseh Kalim add to this, because we need to be able to have a level of trust with him. And so the question is, can you do it when he's speaking innocently, maybe when he's a profession to defend, if he's a chef, and he's going to now defend his profession. Very complex halacha. We generally don't rely on that. What do we rely on? We rely on Mishara B'Shishim. We need 60. So what's 60 doing? 60 is essentially approximating what? The level of to beyond which taste is no longer recognizable. That's why it's important to read the beginning of the halacha. Shishim is the notion of when taste is no longer recognizable. And therefore, we need 16. Okay, fine. And he goes on to say, Chen b'min b'mino, similarly with a min b'mino. This is referring to a tarovis, when we've got a mixture which is either liquid or very small pieces of solids that are mixed together. So the complication comes in, as what Yair mentioned, is what's known as a barrier. Barrier means when you have, one of the exceptions to shishin, is when you have a total unit, which was something which was alive, or and is mixed in into the mixture. So the example that the Shulchan Aruch gives later on in Simon Kuf is, the next halacha, barrier dahayna kagoyin nemolo oif tomei v'gira noshe v'evi minachai v'beitza shiyesh v'oboy afrach v'chiretza v'hem afilu v'elef loy batil. If I have what's called a barrier and it's mixed into my cholent, into my soup, you don't just apply the regular laws of shishim. It's got its own importance that it never disappears or loses its name. So now Yair's case is a little more complex, because now we have a fly. A fly was a living organism, which is now mixed in. We do, ostensibly speaking, as Yair mentioned, there is 60 volume against that fly between the water and the eggs, right? Because you have 5 eggs, right? Right, so 5 eggs, there's certainly enough volume to do regular bittul. But the question is, what about the fly being there? So here's where a lot of people, I myself didn't realize, the next halacha tells us there's a limitation, and that is, if you turn to the next page, Dover shu beria shenis vashil im haheter. Let's say you cook a beria, a fly, with your heter, your eggs, im eina makiro hakol osu. If you cannot see where the fly is, and it's part of the cholent, sounds delicious, right? If you can't see where it is, then you can't eat the entire cholent, because any mouthful you might be eating that fly. However, and the juice is in the volume of taste. If you do see it, zorko, throw out the fly. Then what you do is you say, well, let's imagine the maximum amount of taste that fly could have added, and the maximum amount of taste, so we take the volume of that fly, and we say it added taste. Maybe we dejuiced that fly while we cooked it, right? But the juice of that fly doesn't have a din of barrier. That says the Shulchan Aruch. Right? The juice of the fly isn't a barrier. It's like regular isur, which is floating around in a liquid form. And if we have 60 against the volume of that fly, we're good. And we're safe. Okay? So this happens to be the particular over here. The particular issue, it's considered a bottle. There will be no issue having it, except for perhaps the yach or the och reason. But in terms of halacha, we have bittul, there's no longer a fly in there, and we're safe. Yes?
We have to make sure all the parts don't have any roll off in the
Okay, good question. We're going to come across this about honey in just a moment. So are you worried that maybe the end of the leg of the fly broke off and it's still floating around in your eggs? So that's there's less of a concern with that, and we'll get to that in just a moment, actually, when it comes up in honey. Yes, it does. No, it doesn't make a difference. It's a good question. Shells are breathable. They're absorbing. So we consider that certainly if, let's say you're cooking those eggs with an isra substance, you drop in there a piece of non-kosher meat, then those eggs are osir all the way through. Right? I mean, to say the cooking, we assume that the cooking cooks the taste all the way through. Yes, even though there happens to be a shell in this case.
If you're cooking, let's say, fine eggs, you're making hard-boiled eggs, and a fly falls into that water, all awesome.
No, that's exactly the case. That's exactly a Yair's case. You remove the fly, and then we say that it is bottle. Don't add flies specifically lachadchila, because we say ein uvadin yisro lachadchila. But in the case that it did occur, you remove the fly. There's no longer berry in the mixture. We have 60 against the taste, and we set.
So next topic. As the time went on, my stay in Uganda, I was able to eat more and more food substances as I realized that they were actually kosher. So I remember receiving a very excited email from Rabbi Trump saying, "The milk is kosher. Enjoy your tea with milk, your cereal with milk." Because in the Uganda, they only produce milk from cows and goats. So I couldn't believe it. I wanted to look it up for myself, so I looked on the government regulations website. I found two sources, one from the government, one from an outside regulation source, which really confirmed this. Less than 1% is from other animals like donkeys, bulls, and so on. Everything else is really just cows and goats, primarily cows, actually. And then I also spoke to some of the locals. They said, yeah, they wouldn't even drink goat's milk. That's disgusting. They only drink cow's milk. So then I looked up, like, what would happen if there's any messing around. Like, let's say somebody switches donkey milk for cow milk and then they're caught, what would happen? Because over here, the way I understood was that we can drink chalav stam, regular milk, as opposed to cows that were milked from Jews, by Jews rather, and the reason that it's fine is from this tshuva of Rav Moshe, which says that Anan Sahadi, which I think we'll go through in a second, that because of the government regulations, if there's something that's going on, so it's as if we're over there checking this process or doing this process. And so I didn't know if that would actually fly in Uganda because of the regulations. So I emailed them to find out, like, what exactly would happen if, if there was some messing around, like somebody replaced cow milk with donkey milk. But I didn't get a reply back because I was in Uganda. And so I don't know for sure exactly what would happen, but I can tell you that there definitely were regulations in place and that the official stats had less than 1% of non-cow or goat milk. So I was able to...
What language do you speak in Uganda?
There's like 56 or 58 different dialects. In Kisoro, they speak Rufumbira. We'll get there in a second. So I drank milk not from this cow, but from this Kampala-made milk with my cereal that I brought from home, and it was quite delicious.
So as Yaya was saying, is that one of the there's a number of Isri Darabonim which have been superimposed upon food, and one of them is the Mishnah records in Avodah Zarah. The concept is what's called Chalav Akum. The Mishnah says, "Elu dvarim shel avdei kochavim asurim ve'in yisroel hana, chalav shechel boi avdei kochavim ve'in yisroel ra'eu." If milk is milked by a non-Jew, not in the presence of a Jew, we call that chalav akum, and that is not allowed. And that's been in practice, as opposed to a number of the other gzeres which were revoked because of the people weren't able to live up to. This is something which has been in practice and always has been in practice. However, as you know, Rav Moshe very famously, as Yair just mentioned, points out that the regulations, the government regulations on farms, are such that it is too terrifying for them to play around, to play games. They risk their business or huge fines, and that creates, as I just said, an anan sahadi, which is it's almost as if we can say we saw that they did the day they were milking the cows, because we know that they're too scared not to. And Rav Moshe has three extremely long shuvas on this. His first one's pretty simple, and it's over the span, I think it goes from Sivan to Av in that same year. And the person obviously being very persistent, who's pushing back against Rav Moshe and saying, well, they only get a fine of 2,500, is that sufficient deterrence? There's a whole big discussion that Rav Moshe has over here with us. The OU, in fact, does accept, interestingly enough, that if you look on regular milks, you'll see OUD, right? Because the OU, in fact, relies on this Rav Moshe Lechadchila. There's a fascinating article, Rav Gordeman, who is one of the kashrus coordinators in the dairy section, has very extensive research which is done on this and on government regulations, which is very, very fascinating. What is interesting is you would think, so what knowledge do we have of Uganda? Happens to be one of the kashrus coordinators, Rav Friedman, actually went to Uganda. And so he said, I'm the person, I got an email from him. He said, I was in Uganda, and I know that the only milk being produced is from cows and goats. Meaning to say, so OU's reach is international, and he said, from being there, this is what I saw. So it was very exciting because I know, because if you were to be on a desert island and you needed one substance to have with you all the time, perhaps milk would be the safest thing to do in terms of the amount of mineral content in terms of survival. So therefore, we thank God have Yair the same weight back as originally he started off with, and because of the OU's understanding of even the processing of milk within Uganda itself. Very fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, less than 1% is still an extremely small amount.
So the way when I spoke to the OU did not seem to be concerned about that 1%. They didn't even mention that 1%, meaning to say that they felt that the incentivization for adding anything else was negligible. Meaning, why would somebody else be adding in the donkey's milk? Their main product is their goats and their cows. So there's no, they're not gaining anything by throwing anything else, meaning like they don't have like a lot of camels around the back which they could sell for cheap, and therefore that's the way they understood it best.
One thing, and I'm not an expert, but when you say less than 1%, that means that the validity of the test that you're using is a paper, it doesn't mean there's...
Not sure. I'm not sure if that's the test or that's the reality. Very possible. Could be. I don't know what that represents reflective on, but the OU does not seem to be concerned about it. So just from being there themselves. Okay, so is there economic incentivization? It seems not. It seems that it's not at all. Anyway, fascinating application.
So now we move on to the next survival food, coffee. So I showed you that picture in the beginning when I went to the coffee plant. There we go, survival food. So we picked our own coffee beans together. We processed it using their machinery, then roasted the coffee beans. We basically made coffee from the start to the end, which was pretty cool. Just I didn't know, could I drink the coffee? So I was thinking that I know everybody here drinks Starbucks coffee, so... Probably Bishul Aquam is not a problem. Then I was thinking, is it kosher? Can
roasted,
I believe
it's not,
them?
Roasted.
Rabbi
M.
Okay, so we'll get there, maybe. We'll get there. So that was one. Then I was thinking, okay, is it kosher? Otherwise, because maybe they're using their equipment for other things also. But I asked them, so can I believe them when they say it? They are like a coffee plant. It's not just like an individual who's doing it, although it was just like from their house. But still, I found out they sell their coffee actually in California for, I think, the equivalent of what I got for a dollar. It's like $30 worth, which is pretty nice for the people that bring it back and forth, I guess. But that was the second thing that I was thinking about. And so I figured because they're like a plant, and they're telling me also that they only use it for this, and I'm seeing what they're doing as well, and it seems like they're not using anything else. So I ended up drinking the coffee, and let's find out if that was okay.
Yeah, so actually, this is a very fascinating discussion. Is that this is a prime example. Maybe we should do this at another time. It's just the need of a heksher in the first place. Meaning, if I look at the product, Rabbi, and I turn it around, and I'm reading, and there's nothing else that it says that's non kosher on the back. So what's the problem with me eating this? Right? There's three reasons why that's a problem, in general, why we need a heksher. But one of them is this is a very basic concept, is what's called Bishul Aquam. Bishul Aquam does not mean to say that we're concerned about the ingredients. Bishul Aquam means to say you could have something which is 100% glatt kosher, but was cooked by a non-Jew, and there's an Issur Darabon on eating that. Therefore, the ingredients is not going to be an acid test for how it was processed or cooked. So, in fact, the Aruch HaShulchan describes this Issur. Aruch HaShulchan says, Shlokos, in this on the page 4, shlokos, these are cooked vegetables, shibishal oivikul chavin, umaychul kosher, it is a kosher substance, mikul makom, ostrum chazal, the chumra mipas, it is more strong than pas akum, because you know today many people do not, are not machmir for pas akum. B'simen akoidem, shiakilu boy kama protein, there's a manam of kulas, b'shulin spashto gzeres apas b'chol yisrael, al isu shlokos, the cooking of any cooked substance, it isn't as life-sustaining as bread. V'hi gzeira kadmoinis, it's an earlier gzeira, shekoidem gozru ala pas, gozru ala shlokos. And they even depended on a pasuk, v'asmechu akrog v'vur v'perek ein ma'amidim d'dorish lo, min oichel ba'kesef tasbireini, ayin sham, and the Gemara of Avodah Zarah bases on a pasuk. He goes on to say that the original reason is because of chasnus, is that when you have joint meals and somebody else is cooking for you and your neighbor says, oh, why don't you just come over and I'll cook you a meal and I'll make sure I get all the kosher ingredients, we don't want that. Because that's going to end up, you know, they're going to get all friendly, my kids are going to hang out and they're going to grow up and they're going to go to the same school and they're going to start dating and then you never know what's going to happen next. And unfortunately, if you think this is far-fetched, look at society today. So what happens is that there's one of the reasons of Bishul Akum is because of the actual the community fostering that it creates. And number two is because we're concerned that they may add something. Okay, they may add something to it, which is unfortunately when you go to plant production is something which the OU, if you go to listen to kashrut coordinators, you should hear just how many crazy instances you hear of people adding things. Not because they want to make us eat not kosher. Just for simple basic reasons, they run out of the right cheese. Right. And they send something around the corner because they need to produce this line by the end of the day, right? Things like that. So there are really certain concerns with Bishul Akum which exists. So the question is does this apply to everything? So there's two exceptions to Bishul Akum. There's two exceptions. Yeah. Exception number one is that it has to be something which needs to be cooked. So therefore, if it's carrots and they cook a carrot for you, that's not a problem because you can eat a carrot raw. Right, so therefore the process itself hasn't necessarily facilitated anything. So you're allowed to eat the carrot even if they cooked it for you. Number two, if it's something which is not oyle b'shulchan melachim, if it's not something which should be served on the royal table. So example being, let's say cereal. Right? Let's say something which doesn't come to dignitary's table, therefore there would not be a bishul akum on that. Right? You'll notice on a lot of Kellogg's cereals there's no kashrus symbols. This is just an interesting discussion. Why not? Okay? Now, happens to be, over here about coffee, let's go through this for a second. Coffee, can you eat it raw? Not really, right? Meaning, there are people who like that, but in general it's not eaten raw, so that we fulfill condition number one. Number two is, do you think you get it at you know, major events? The answer is yes. So really on both the conditions it should be susceptible to Bishul Akum. However, the fascinating reason why, in fact, today we do not say there's Bishul Akum on coffee is for a very interesting reason. And that is what's happening over here is we're boiling up water and we're putting something into that water which is yielding a taste. Right? So what happens is the Achronim say the following. Well, let's look at beer for a second. Right? Beer is, well, original beer before we get to all the sophisticated chemistry of today. But regular beer is where what do? You ferment barley in water, right? There's a fermentation process, and you're drinking the beer. What bracha do you say on beer? Shekel, why don't you say Borei Mi'ayim Hazonos? Okay, so what we say, so what happens is in the halachic process, we view this as water which is flavored, albeit strongly flavored, and albeit even prosecutably flavored. But nonetheless, it's still considered water with a taste. Therefore, we don't say the bracha Borei Mi'ayim Hazonos when we have the wheat or the barley added. So therefore, the pre chadash from the earlier achronim on the Shulchan Aruch says, I'm not going to do it inside, but he says, therefore, similarly speaking, when you're heating up tea or coffee, what essentially are you doing? He's essentially boiling water for you. Can you drink water beforehand? The answer is yes. It's something which is nechal k'moy shulchai. Coffee can be drunken raw. Therefore, they're not facilitating anything in the process. It's been added a taste. You're adding a taste to it. That's not sufficient grounds to create Bishul Akum. Which is one of the reasons today we say that it's considered Maya Ba'alma, it's considered water, and therefore coffee itself does not have the concerns of Bishul Akum. The other concern that Yair was mentioning was the machinery, right? Meaning we don't know what else is produced on that machinery. However, being as Yair was there, and he saw, in fact, what the machinery is being used for, and in these very simple plants, there's a very high unlikelihood that they're going to be using it for else. When you have a bigger concern is when you have a huge major power plant with sophisticated machinery and you don't know what they're running. You don't know what else they're using their machinery for. When you're dealing with a backyard production over here, and they're not selling this on a grand scale, there's much less of a concern in that particular instance, which is what yields this fascinating result.
Is that why most of these are such that when they
Oh, the caskets, yeah, much more complicated. We have to get to the scotch and the caskets and the cherry car, that's going to be a little more complicated. There's a lot else going on over there. Yeah?
If you're worried about the Gentiles are going to put food in the food, why is it you can get around Bishul Akum just like a Jew comes and starts the fire? That's enough.
We'll get there in a second. We'll get to the Bishul Akum in a case when we get to the
flat. What about the
vessel? You know, if it's all right, I just want to, you know, we don't have an incredible amount of time. I wanted, if it's all right, just to cover a little bit of ground. We may have to revisit this at this point, but I want to just cover a little bit more ground with the iron, if it's all right, just to save some of the questions.
So this is a picture from when I went to Rwanda right before I left. The market was not quite indoors like this in Kisoro, Uganda. But this is a nice illustration of my diet, for the most part, which was fruits. So especially when I went to restaurants, I would get just a fruit salad. I would get bananas, mango sometimes, once it started coming into season, passion fruit, and then I wasn't sure, can I eat the pineapple? So at first, because I was worried that maybe it's sharp, right? They're cutting it with their knives, and so I was worried that if they're going to cut the pineapple with their knife, even if it's clean, ostensibly, and even if it's cold, still maybe I thought a pineapple should be like a davar harif, that it should absorb the taste of the knife, and so I didn't want to eat the pineapple at first, so I was eating the rest of the fruit salad, and then I asked Rabbi Trump, found out that it's not a davar harif, and so pineapple was added to my rich diet as well, which made me extremely happy. And I also bought my own pineapples, of course, which was quite nice.
So interesting enough, so when you're just referring to this notion of davar harif, Davar Harif is another exception to the rule of Bittul. Bittul hits at the threshold of 60, which is where we say taste disappears, the 1 to 60 ratio. However, one of the exceptions is Davar Harif. Let's say I'm eating a substance, and into that substance I can still taste the other substance in it, which is Asur. Even though you have the right ratios, it's still a problem of Bittul. But the example that Yair was talking about is the following. Is the Gemara says that let's say you're cutting up if you're cutting a radish, the Gemara's example is that you're cutting it up with a knife, you cannot eat it. And what's the example the Gemara gives over here is Sinoin Shechadach Vesakin Shechazah Babasar Asur La'Ochla V'Kutach. You have a meat knife and you're cutting up a radish, you can't eat that radish now with milk. Why? Meaning, we're talking about a clean knife. You have a clean knife using it. It was used on meat previously, but I'm using it to cut up now a radish. That radish now is not allowed to be eaten with milk. So we say something interesting. Even though that the knife is clean, and so there's no meat on the blade itself, what happens over here is the following. Is we say, and based on the Rashi over there, is that two aspects of the activity over here activate perhaps anything which is inside it. So the Rashi would say is that there might be particles of meat which were perhaps absorbed into the blade, or a thin film on the blade, even though it's regularly cleaned or rinsed, wouldn't necessarily be visible to the eye, which are still in that blade. Cutting, let's say you're using it for a cold substance, so let's say I'm cutting bread and I'm cutting it cold, I could eat that bread with milk. Because we don't say that film or grease or those inner particles which have been absorbed into the blade are necessarily a problem. However, when you cut a sharp substance, where you have two aspects, one aspect is where you have the pressure of the cutting, and number two, where you have the actual sharpness of the davar harif of the radish, what happens is those two aspects activate or pull out those particles which may have been meat, and now we say that those particles are now actually embedded in the radish. Okay, so we have perhaps old meat particles which are in this radish, which now disallows us from eating it with milk. That's how the davar harif operates. So the question is the following is, so that means to say that's even beyond 24 hours. Meaning even if it's a beyond 24 hours in the snuff, we say it's mechali ale isur akama, which means to say that it activates the isur even beyond the 24-hour period, which is usually our safe zone for taste. And what happens is that you have a davar harif. So your blade is now imparting this isur to the object, which is why cutting lemons, cutting radishes, cutting garlic is always a problem depending on what blade you're using. So Yair's question was, is the pineapples, meaning they could have had clean blade, but they could have been using it in the butchery just 2 minutes ago and cleaned it, or even a few days ago, and they would have used the same cleaver and they were cutting the pineapple, so you're going to be stuck now. Happens to be that the Aruch HaShulchan points out, and he gives it, and many of the later Akronim point out, that the list that the Shulchan Aruch gives about what are considered Davar Charif might be exhaustive, meaning to say, if examples the Shulchan Aruch give, are they the only examples, or are they actually just a framework for future examples? We paskin in general that pineapples doesn't make the cut for a Davar Charif, and therefore we would say that using that blade to cut the pineapple would not necessarily activate that. The more complicated part of the Shaila is the following. Is in general, let's say you go to a function at your workplace, and now you have cut fruit, right? And you have a whole platter of cut fruit, and you don't know where, and you don't know, well, can I eat this or not? So this is where it becomes interesting. We assume that you could, if it was bought, let's say from a supermarket which produces generally cut fruit. They produce fruit platters. You would be able to. The reason is interesting. Is let's say that there was this substance in or embedded in the knife, and we're not talking about sharp substances, right? So let's say it wasn't a clean knife. They start cutting up a mango, and then they cut up an apple, and then they cut up an orange. We assume that the pressure of the cutting cleans the knife upon three or four cuts. So that means to say that there are three or four pieces which may have the dirty substance on it in that platter. But the problem, what happens is now those four pieces get mixed in with the rest of the platter, and we say it's bottle. Could you do that lechachila? No. But now that the platter's arrived at your workplace, you can sufficiently rely on the fact that there may be four pieces which are also but they're bottle and the rest. That only works when you get from a place that makes fruit platters. If you come to a restaurant now, and the restaurant's making cut-up fruit, you have no reason to believe that knife was ever really fully clean. They could have been using it for something else right beforehand. And also, because the amount of cutting, so here's an example, how many pieces did you do of cut fruit?
50.
Right, so 50 would be sufficient. But let's say somebody's in the room with you and he says, I'm going to cut it up with you, and they pull their knife off the counter and they slice up a mango into 8 pieces. That's not enough grounds to rely on that, because first of all, there's not sufficient amount of fruit for bittul. And also, you don't know what else they're using the knife for. When you come to a supermarket, which usually has knives specifically for the fruit platter section, one can rely on the fact that even if it may not be in kosher knife, it would be bottle on the rest. So it depends on the magnitude and also where one's getting it from, which would apply to in this particular case.
What happens when you're in a motel and having breakfast and they have cut up fruit? You can eat it?
I would say that's more like a restaurant, because they don't have specifically designated knives for the fruit in that case, and therefore you would have a problem. We're talking about where you would buy from a supermarket which has a section which produces fruit platters.
And therefore... washed it, and it's not
really
nice
charm.
Yeah, of course, but that's not generally the case. I mean, you don't usually go into a restaurant and say, would you mind if I walk into the kitchen and let me wash your knives for you? But in general, if you're to come, this happens with fish, is if you go to a fishmonger and you know it's a kosher fish and you bring your own knife, you're set. Yeah.
Cutting surface
is not the problem. That's only the blade itself, because that's the pressure, where the pressure is exerted. Yeah. Let's cover one or two more cases, and then I think we're going to have to hold it for today, if that's all right.
And we're going to go back and cover these topics
on what you've done. Oh, so what we're doing right over here is we're really actually just, each of these could be an entire shiur in of itself. We're really, these are just, this is mamish a survey. But I think it's a fascinating survey because it just gives you a sense of the complexity of what's applied to around everyday life.
So the next case involved a Davar Charif. So I went with a total of us 7 friends, went, none of the others are Jewish. But they were very accommodating towards me. I remember we were heading one place for Shabbos, and the others were as concerned as I was for making it there on time, so they were counting off T-minus 2 hours, T-minus 1 hours. So it's kind of nice. They also wanted to make kosher food that I'd be able to eat. So we were once making kosher guacamole. I was supervising, and so the avocados were fine. That all worked well. The tomatoes were fine. That all worked well. I went back to get my own red pepper because I wasn't sure about the red pepper from there, if they dry it with anything else, how exactly they do it, and also how exactly they cut it. So I went to get my own red pepper, and as I come back, I see that they're squeezing lime, which they cut with their knife, right? So lime is a Davar Charif. Their knife is not my knife, and so it certainly cut meat or some other things which are not kosher. And so they were squeezing that lime into the kosher guacamole. And so my question was, can I eat this kosher guacamole? Not quite a survival food in this case, although guacamole was a survival food overall. I just wasn't sure if I can eat it because I figured, does the taste from the knife go into just that area which is cut, or does it go into the whole lime? And if it goes into the whole lime, then when we squeeze the lime in, and I can now taste the lime in my guacamole, so regardless if there's shishim or not, if there's actually 60 times the amount, would it be batel or would it not? So since this was not really an immediate question, I asked this one to Rabbi Trump too, and the answer that I got...
It was interesting. This is actually a very fascinating shot, because based on what we've learned already this morning, what would you say in this case? Would there be bitzel? Let's say, because we know that a davar charif, so let's say that nav imparted taste, which is non-kosher, into that lime. And we say, because the pressure of the nav and the fact that it was sharp, now we call it non-kosher lime. So now, would there be bitzel? Would you allow there to be bitzel in this case? You'd say no. Why? Because when I'm tasting this guacamole, the reason I like the lime is there because I can taste it. If I couldn't taste it, I wouldn't put it there. Right? So now, that means to say that when I'm actually tasting it, I'm tasting that lime. So now you might say, and ostensibly you would say, there's no bitzel over here, right? Because I can taste it. That's the threshold of bitzel. However, fascinating halacha is the halacha tells us the following. In this particular instance over here, just going flipping over to the top of page 6, this is the Shulchan Aruch. Kol ha'isurim anoyim b'zman hazeh, kulam mispatlim b'shishin. All isurim of bottle have an annulment at the threshold of 60. The ratio of 60 milvad chametz b'pesach v'yayin nesach. Okay, there's a very interesting reason why. Kashin is bar b'ilchaseyem in the Torah. B'vad sha'isur eino noisen tam b'kdera. V'al noisen tam b'oisa k'dera. V'hu asur mitzad atzmoy afilu b'elef loy bottle. If you can taste it, it's never bottle on the threshold of 60. But the condition is, v'hu asur mitzad atzmoy. That the isur in that substance which you can taste is intrinsic isur. Meaning to say that therefore it is very spicy pork, which is in the stew, and I can always taste that pork when I'm eating the stew. But over here, what's the osir substance over here? The osir substance is the taste imparted from the naf into the lime. What am I tasting? I'm tasting the lime. The lime's not osir mitzad atzmoy. It doesn't have intrinsic isur. It has isur imparted into it. At this point in time, what we would conclude is that because when I'm tasting this guacamole, I'm only tasting the lime and not the taste of meat which is imparted into it, or the treif which is imparted into it via that knife, there should be sufficient bittel on that taste, because there certainly is 60 in the guacamole, which can overcome the volume of isur which came in through this knife. That's what we would conclude, based on this Shulchan Aruch that we just read. However, and this is the last concept we're going to cover today, the last concept is the following. And this is what is a very fascinating aspect of halacha. It's called chanan. Chaticha na'aseis nevela. What we say is that we view a substance sequentially. We look at a substance and a mixture in different stages. So actually, over here, there were actually two mixtures going on. Which means to say, the first mixture was when the knife was cutting the lime, and there's a mixture between the taste or the meat particles or the treif particles which were on this knife, which are now imparted into the lime. That's mixture number one. Mixture number two is we say that we look at the second mixture of the lime juice and the guacamole. And what halacha says is that if it happens in two stages, we say chaticha na'ases nevela. We look at that lime, and because we are absorbing out of that knife blade via the sharpness and of the lime and the pressure of the blade, what happens is that the taste of treif comes out into that lime. We now say that this lime is na'aseis chaticha. It becomes an entire treif item, which is an incredible idea. We view the first mixture and we say that this mixture now is a treif mixture. We view the entire lime as a treif substance. Now we put the lime into the food. We put the lime into the guacamole. We're viewing it as if the lime itself is treif, because of the concept of chanan, chaticha na'asas nevela. The way it's described in the Gemara is the following. If I have a drop of milk and it lands onto one meatball, and then that meatball falls into a soup with a whole bunch of other meatballs, you don't say that I'm measuring 60 against the drop of milk. I measure 60 against the entire meatball, because that chaticha, that piece, that meatball itself became treif. Now that you have a treif meatball, you need to measure 60 against that treif meatball. I now have treif lime juice. I need to be able to measure against that lime juice, 60 against the entire lime juice itself. And therefore, in this case, it may be a little more difficult to be able to make that measurement. In addition, if you're unsure if there's a volume against that entire lime juice of 60, you may run into the problem that you can't add any more guacamole to mitigate the issue, because we say, Einu vatlin isra lechadchila. We can't create bittul lechadchila in advance. We have to wait until we have the situation and say, well, was there bittul? And if you're not sufficiently sure, as Yari wasn't in this case, it would be better not to eat the guacamole.
As you can see, we didn't even get to luxury foods yet. Just basics, guacamole and coffee and milk. Maybe what we'll do is we'll come back on this, because we haven't even gotten to the trips yet. We haven't even gotten to the field trips and all the exciting questions about Shabbos and Eruv and Tchum and national parks and all the very exciting things which occur as well. So rather than rushing and really trying to squish it in, maybe what we'll do is we'll take a round two, and we'll investigate and enjoy our trip through Uganda at a more reasonable pace as well. So I want to very much thank Yair, and I want to thank you all for being here.